know, this is actually, it's a good question, because often this happens in terms of, we talk of the moment, but personally I think often sometimes it's nearly better to say, to look, to try to be aware at the multiplicity of the present, the relatively present experience, and you have a long way. Because actually, the moment is constantly going, it's constantly moving. And actually, we are a little bit in the past, little bit in the present, little bit in the future. We are in motion. And it's true that if we fix the moment in a way, sometimes actually what we do is that we grasp at it, and then we hold on to it. And then actually the moment frees. And there is less this feeling of us accompanying the moment which is flowing. So I think it's kind of like seeing. When is it, in a way, there is a little like a fixation, and straight away you find a little kind of generally a tightness, there is a little something which changes. And when is it that I am more in the flow of the experience? And so it's kind of to play with this. It's the same. If you focus on the breath, sometimes it becomes very mechanical. Like you are doing it. When the idea is more of following the breath, resting on the breath. And so it's kind of like, it's nearly when there is nearly more self, what I would call more self-consciousness, that often this happens. But it's true that sometimes if we look very, 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 very minutely, but then we go very much just in concentration. And then that, we talk more about samadhi, and then you can do it walking or sitting, and this is kind of a little differently than what we want to kind of look at the moment, where we, there is more the samatha and the vipassana together, and so we try to be more with kind of flowing with the moment.
In a way, the moment doesn't really exist. I mean, the present moment, which is given so much, you hear about it all the time. I've never found the present moment. It's extremely elusive. And I think this is the case with a number of these instructions, is that we often take them too literally. When it says be in the moment, we assume therefore there is a present moment, which is not the past and not the future, and somehow we're going to lock ourselves into this, but it's not like that. We have to remember that this is it's a skillful means. It's a didactic method to help us put aside our preoccupations with what's already past, our preoccupations with what's yet to come, and to concentrate simply on what's happening. And I think sometimes the notion of the moment almost inhibits that. It narrows us too much. There's a passage I have here in the handout where, again, it's referring to this conditioned arising. And a monk comes to the Buddha, and he's got some questions about the past, I seem to recall. And anyway, the Buddha replies, "Let be the past. Let be the future. I will teach you the Dhamma. When this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises." Now, interestingly, he doesn't mention the word the present at all. In fact, he says, don't bother with the past, don't bother with the future. I'll teach you the Dhamma. And then he gives one of his standard descriptions of conditioned arising. So when we're walking, we're actually not so much interested in the moment at some specific sort of narrow bit of time, but rather, according to this, noticing rather how the processes of our movement, in this case, our movement of the body, are giving rise one to the next. The lifting of the foot has an effect on the movement of the body forward, the placing of the foot, but there's no point at which you can single out a present. And I think your question is interesting, because there is the problem. That is the problem, is we can become fixated on a particular point, we can linger rather than be present with what's going on. But lingering is, in a way, a kind of preoccupation again, a kind of a holding. Whereas what the Buddha seems to be suggesting here is rather to be totally open to the complexities of this unfolding process that's going on, without being too concerned about present, past, and future. Putting aside in our mind any preoccupation with what's gone or what's to come, that's useful. But that allows us to be more aware with the unfolding of things, the emergence of things, the connections between one step and the next. It's really an instruction that helps us experience this conditioned arising in a much more felt and immediate and non-conceptual way. So that may be more helpful than thinking of it in the language of the present moment. I think it's choice and responsibility really are within the realm of morals and ethics, not so much emerging out of our description of how, let's say, this conditioned arising works. I think they're two quite different things. It's true that when we try to pinpoint anything, be it the present moment or be it an object of awareness, that we find that whether it's time or whether it's a spatial object, we cannot in the end pin it down. It blurs into what conditions that gave rise to it, what preceded it, what followed it. Also, we become aware that we're somehow constructing it through our perceptions, through our making sense of it, and so on. That's an exercise that I feel is valuable in opening us up to this ground of emergence, and that's, I think, a useful pragmatic instruction in the sort of practice we're doing. But I think it also establishes another foundation, another ground, on which we then make choices and make decisions and take responsibility. In other words, this unfolding experience is not just happening in some sort of neutral, non-moral sense.
Can I give an example?
Yeah, sure.
I would like to give an example of the air conditioning. So, you're sitting here, and you arrive in the room, and there is the air conditioning. So you sit there. So the condition is the air conditioning is on. But then it is your choice what you do about that. You can sit there and say, oh, it's on. Or you can say, oh, it's there. I hate air conditioning. I mean, you know. And then you can go into all kind of different ways, you know, and I'm really going to tell them about this. Or you sit there and think, oh, this is so wonderful, I hope they leave it on, etc., etc. So in a way, you have a contact, you have condition, inner and outer condition, but then you have moral agency of what you do with it. It's not the conditioner, the air conditioning, who is going to tell you how to think. I mean, I could tell you possibly how to think, but generally, you will think, Of course, according to if you are the cold type or the warm type, and possibly if you have a tendency to be the angry type or the calm type. But this is why we do meditation, so that it's less automatic. I hate it, I love it. Instead of, oh, it's happening, how can I creatively engage with it?
Yeah, that's a very good example. But I tend to be more abstract in these things. But, I was going to make the same point in a rather roundabout way. The world presents itself to us, as whether we're mindful or not, but let's say that we are trying to be more present, more aware of what's happening. That is still going to leave us in the basic human situation where events will occur that require us to make decisions, and the example of the air conditioner, for example. So the question really is that it provides us with another context for making choices. We become more conscious of how we very often habitually just react. As Martin was saying, if it's pleasant, we want it, if it's unpleasant, we don't want it, and there's a kind of reactivity. Now, is that a genuine choice? Or is that really just a habit that has kicked in because we're so familiar to behaving in such a way? So arguably, the opening up of that space of attention, that slowing down, that being more attentive to the not only the events outside, but also of the rising of feelings and emotions and thoughts, we become more sensitized to the conditions in which we then make a decision and make a choice, and that is part of the whole process too. But are you sort of moving on to the question of free will? Is that at the back of this?
Well, I can say that observing the process of, for example, being called and trying to decide what to do about it shows me that a lot more complicated than simply choosing, because I'm not really choosing, I'm not starting choice. I'm made of conditions, so it doesn't start from
yes.
This. It starts from I don't know where.
It's
going
mysterious.
Through me, but
that's right.
So can I even take responsibility for my action? I'm not so sure. Can I call it a choice? I'm not so sure.
Well, from that sort of rather strict phenomenological reading, it does get tricky. But I think choice really operates in the sphere of our relationships with others. It will have an impact on what every serious choice we make. Let's say not whether we have the air conditioning on or not, but whether I marry this woman or not. And that's a rather more serious one, perhaps. That it's true that that choice will emerge out of a set of conditions, and in some senses is not separate from it. At a certain point, those conditions seem to coalesce into a thought, into an intention that becomes stronger and stronger, recurs more and more, and we nonetheless have the freedom to follow it or not. And it's that if we don't have that, then I think this whole process becomes rather pointless. And if you look at how in the classical model of how this conditioned arising works, it all comes to a crunch point at Vedana, at the feeling tone, which Martin is going to talk about this afternoon. And let's say we're sitting in meditation here, we feel a very strong attraction towards something. Something very pleasant is perhaps coming up in our minds, a fantasy, a scenario. And do we or do we not have the freedom to follow that or to simply notice it? That's the crucial thing. In the practical sense, that's the crucial moment. Do we just allow ourselves to get swept away with what's building up within us? Or do we have a capacity to simply notice it and reflect on it, see it for just another play of the mind, if you wish, and not get caught up in it? If we assume that we have no freedom to make such choices, then one has to question really what value this sort of practice can have. Otherwise, it's just becoming, you are just a kind of a marionette, a puppet being swept along by the great tide of conditions with no moral agency, no responsibility,
but
no direction, no focus.
It was very clear in the fact that in the Eightfold Path, not only do you have right intention, but to me what is more interesting, you have right effort. And what the Buddha talks, when he talks about efforts, actually he talks about conditions. And to me this is in a way, the Buddha is view was of condition, to see how conditions influence us. And how by cultivating certain positive conditions like meditation, then it does make a difference. It makes a change to the choice we made. Because personally, I don't feel you are all sitting here, either with the air conditioning on or off, just because you have nothing better to do. And you're just automated. You have the choice to come here. You have the choice to sit there. You have the choice to be aware. And it's interesting in the meditation to see when actually we go on automatic, and when we don't. It's very interesting to see when we see the changing nature and where we're caught by our obsession. It's very different. You have a very different feeling.
You were talking before about grasping the negative aspect of grasping on place, on nation, on identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand the negative aspect of it, the
mm-hmm.
price to pay for grasping.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that we need something to grasp. It's this.
Yes.
Psychologically,
mm-hmm.
because I think of myself. I need to belong to a family. I need to feel I belong. I feel that maybe the grasping part or the place that I feel I'm part of is a base for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives me security. And without it, if you strip me away from nation, from
mm-hmm.
family, from language,
mm-hmm.
from self-identity, I don't think I will be able to live in this world.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be, I would be very anxious, maybe just fall apart.
Well, you see, I was trying to make that point, that you cannot live without being from a certain place, in a certain family, having a social position, having certain beliefs, having certain views. That's impossible. It's impossible not to have those things. They are part of our life. They're integral to our existence and our identity. And that's not in itself a problem. The problem arises when we begin to hold on to those things too tightly. We begin to think that our security and our well-being rests entirely on our ability to secure ourselves, to sustain ourselves by identifying ever more strongly with those conditions. And in doing so, we cut ourselves off from life. We become, it's like some of these caricatural fanatics, who can only think about their football team, or can only think about their particular interpretation of their religion, or can only think about waving their national flag. I think we can all see that that's going a little too far. But the danger would be to then say, oh, then we don't need any of those things at all. We can become wandering freely and like a little cloud or something, which is, you find those images in Buddhism. And the Buddha, of course, says a great deal about detachment, about renunciation, about letting go of these things. But if we take that too literally, we end up in another kind of contradiction, really. Because we cannot not be of a place, not be of a community, not be... It's not possible. So the question really is not in whether these things are somehow good or bad or right or wrong, but rather a question of how do we learn, or can we learn to live with them more lightly? Can we hold those things without grasping at them,
because
without making them into sort of obsessions? It's the obsessiveness that's the problem. It's the craving that's the problem. Even the word Dhamma actually comes from the root word to hold. The Dhamma, in a sense, is what holds us. It's the same. Grasping is, in a sense, a sort of intensified hold, where we squeeze too tightly around something, and in doing so, limit and restrict ourselves in a way that is perhaps unhealthy, that cuts us off from our ground, the actual living processes of life that are pouring forth all the time. We don't see that anymore. We only see our obsession. So it's really about obsession and the problems with that. It's not about rejecting any sense of identity or community or position or role. It's a question of how do we live with that without alienating ourselves from the ground of life itself.
Because you see, I think you have to see grasping fixes us, reduces us to what we grasp at. But then what we're trying to develop here is not going into some kind of realm when there would be nothing. But it's more in a way to take out the holding, so that then there is more creative engagement with identity, with country, with family. And so in a way there is a different relationship. So I think often we have the idea that non-grasping means zero grasping. But we have to survive. This organism has to survive. So personally, I think more what we try to do is to move from 90% toward 50%. And then it's more kind of, again, the middle way. If we look at ourselves, a lot of the time we're very, really focused on the self and the attribute of the self. But it's more kind of all these things, all the conditions that forms me. How do I creatively engage with them? I think that's what we're working on, instead of, in a way, abandoning everything and then floating on a cloud somewhere.
Okay, here. Oh, and that. All right, we'll get to everybody. Yes. Well, yes, of course he does. But the problem, he mentions a word called asankata. Now, when we translate that into English, it often becomes the unconditioned, very often with a big U. And so, yes, it's there, the term. But in fact, there's a passage. Did I include it here? I think there's a passage here, in fact. Here we go, the unconditioned on page 9 here. In fact, there's a very famous passage that Western Buddhists love to quote, which says, there is, monks, are not born and not brought to being and not made and not conditioned or an unconditioned. If, monks, there were not an unconditioned, no escape would be discerned from what is born, made, conditioned, and so on. Now, this passage appears in a text called the Udana. It occurs once in the canon, but it is quoted endlessly. And I think, and the interesting question is why? What is it that we find in this passage that somehow is reassuring? And I think what we find is a substitute for God. And that, I think, is therein that the attraction to the idea lies. But if we go to another text, which is called the Asankata Samyutta, the connected discourses on the unconditioned, then the Buddha says what he means. And he says, I will teach you the unconditioned and the path leading to the unconditioned. Listen to that. And what, monks, is the unconditioned? The destruction of greed, the destruction of hatred, the destruction of delusion. That is called the unconditioned. Right? That's not what we probably had in mind. It's difficult to think of God as the ending of hatred, the ending of delusion. And what, monks, is the path leading to the unconditioned? Mindfulness directed to the body. In other words, he brings us right back into our immediate experience here and now. So what I think is going on here is the Buddha is probably taking a term that would have been used at his time, that would have referred to Brahman, the unconditioned, and he gives it a totally new twist. And in fact, I think what he's doing is he's turning it from a noun into a verb. And he's saying, unconditioned doesn't refer to some transcendent state. It refers to the possibility that you can live in this world unconditioned by greed, unconditioned by hatred, unconditioned by confusion. So he turns what would perhaps have been a metaphysical belief about a transcendent God or an unconditioned reality and turns it into a practical injunction to live your life unconditioned by those forces, those drives, like greed and hatred and so on, that keep on leading us into cycles of frustration and habit. So you have to be careful in how the word is being used, in what context it's being used, and also in terms of what it is that draws you or attracts you to that idea. And then I think you can begin to unpack some of this admittedly difficult language.
Yes.
Well, I think that what attracted me, what the question came for me, is that I find something in this, in all this description of conditions arising, a bit uninspirational. I mean, a bit kind of dry.
Yeah.
And my question actually was, where does love come into this?
Where does love come into
this?
Well, I think love comes into it a great deal.
Yeah.
But it comes into it by letting go or learning how to break down what prevents us from loving.
Yeah.
Right? And what prevents us from loving is our greeds, our hatreds, our fears. So if we can learn to live in this world, in this conditioned world, without being trapped in the demands of our ego, that will have the effect also of opening us up to the suffering of the world. And that gives us the possibility of empathy. We'll come back to that. And it's without empathy there can be no love. And yet with greed and hatred and fear there can be no empathy. So this is a methodology really to help us open up not just our understanding, but also our feelings, our emotions, our felt relationship to life itself.
There are two small thoughts arising in my head when you were talking before about this and that and this and that and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
You said it again and again, and I sort of started to translate these two words in all the languages I know, which are a few, and I thought that all the little children, when they are 1 year old, it's the first thing they say.
Yeah.
This and that, and this and that. And that maybe we are born much more intelligent than we are later, and they are not really focused on one thing. They are every 2 seconds going to something
mm-hmm.
else, and they don't grab it, and they don't stay there. You can give them the most beautiful toy, they will go to the box and play with it, and go on, and go on, and go on, and see much more openly everything around the moment, or not the moment, or the next moment. And somehow one of my questions was, why are we growing up to, and we have to start again to learn meditation? I think little children are much more open. And the second was, you more or less answered now. The second question was about unconditional love. But I always thought I'm unconditionally loving my children, grandchildren, friends, and also suddenly I thought there is no unconditional. There is, it is conditional in some way. But now you answered, before I asked, that the uncondition is by this conditioning the bad. When I'm not hating, I'm unconditionally loving.
Yes,
when I'm not grabbing, I'm so you answered my second question, you answered already, I think.
The adult person grows up, the adult person tends to become fixated more on ideas and concepts rather than the direct experience of things. And so we become concerned with what I was speaking of as our position, our place, our identity. We like that. And we like our religion too, to present us with similar unitary ideas, like the unconditioned or the deathless or God or whatever. But what the Buddha seems to be doing is a bit like coming back to that experience we had as children, where we were simply satisfied and entirely adequate just to be with a piece of wood or whatever it might be. There is, I think, a return to that kind of simplicity. And again, when we use words like unconditioned, or we use words like freedom, liberation, the Buddha always understands these as relational ideas. In other words, unconditioned, you then have to say, unconditioned by what? Freedom. Freedom from what? Enlightenment. Enlightenment about what? The adult mind so easily makes these things into absolutes, makes them into things entirely real, cut off from the actual fluidity of lived experience. So this return to lived experience is very much, I think, coming back to an encounter with what's actually happening in our sensory experience, and being more alert to how we habitually react to that, rather than maybe respond to it in an open, in a more creative manner. There you had a question, didn't you?
Yeah.
No, you didn't. So there and then here. Or here first, I don't know which.
I don't know if I have a question or comment about...
Well, either one's fine.
About your interpretation, translation of the Ida Pachayata in the novel Third.
Yeah.
And I've got my impression of the good description of conditionality.
Mm.
And I think that Pachayata would translate as conditionality better than condition, it's an abstract noun.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the Buddhist interest is not so much in the conditionality in the world.
Mm.
So it's not about the air conditioning or
sure.
How trees are conditioned by the whatever. It's merely an interest in how suffering is conditioned. What are the conditions for suffering? And the whole sequence of spiritual origination is about that. How? What are the conditions and how to overcome them? Get rid of the conditions and unconditioned suffering.
Yeah, yeah.
I say that. And I wonder if
no, I agree with that. I don't think the Buddha is interested in providing us with an airtight description of the world. He's not interested in description. In fact, I think he's primarily interested in prescription. In other words, giving us suggestions of something to do, not some picture of the world to believe in and to argue about. That, I feel, is very, very central to the whole business. And yet we so easily take a prescriptive term, like unconditioned, and turn it into a description. In other words, it refers to something, the unconditioned, which I think is quite, it's an easy mistake to make, and I think Buddhists have done it again and again and again, but it misses the point. It's the same with the present moment business. This is a, you know, the getting, not being in the past and the future, it's not saying the present is somehow more real, but it's an instruction, it's an advice, it's a suggestion that if we were to actually put that into practice, it would begin to change the way we respond, that we relate to the world, the way we grasp at things or don't grasp at things. It all has to do with a kind of praxis. And if we keep that perspective in mind, I think that gives us the framework within which to understand what these teachings are about. And as you say, that is, it as the Buddha is asked often, what is your teaching? It is suffering and how to bring suffering to an end. And if we lose that perspective, then I think we end up getting caught up in philosophical and theological questions, which are really actually rather beside the point.
Yes.
Yes.
I have two questions. One is if you can share with us, both of you, your personal path, journey, and how percentage do you feel you are awakened? Or maybe you're full awakened, I don't know. And did you meet fully awakened masters, I mean living masters? That's the question. And also, thank you for the explanation about the present moment, because it's really so vague, and I enjoy the idea of having a state of mind that is open and wondrous, like a little child, yes?
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, did the Buddha think that this place is a benevolent place? I mean, we can trust
the world,
and jump like a bungee, not knowing, you know, like this surrender to what is, embracing it.
There's an awful lot of questions there. I'm not so sure we have the time to go into our personal journeys. Especially in what, the 3 or 4 minutes that remains.
Maybe the last one is we can do.
You respond to the last bit, yes.
Okay, you see, I think the Buddha, to me, was quite realistic. And he could see that there was dangerous thing in the world, and there is also places of safety in the world. Basically, again, he was aware of conditions. What I would call inner conditions, outer conditions. And that often we have the feeling when we do meditation that we're going to a place which is going to be above conditions. But actually the Buddha, it seems to me, was more, look out. You have negative conditions, negative and positive outer conditions, negative and positive inner conditions. And so it's not just in here. You know, he often said to his monk, don't go to dangerous place, you'll get into trouble. He said to, I mean, one of my favorite, he says to lay people, don't saunter at night. You know, like deep in the night, don't saunter. Why?
Don't wander about.
Don't wander about at night, late at night. And why? Because you're more likely to get arrested. Secondly, you're more likely to be attacked. Thirdly, your house will not be protected. So it seemed very kind of, you know, realistic. And then you look, what are the conditions that are going to help us within ourselves and outside of ourselves? So I think it's kind of, again, looking at that. What is it I can cultivate? How can I cultivate things in myself? So there is, again, back to the welfare of self, of others and the world. And this is a main message of the Buddha, is harmlessness. That we are harmless, and also that we help others. I mean, he talks again and again of loving kindness, compassion, etc. So that's one. Another question was about, did we meet enlightened masters?
Fully awakened.
Fully
awakened.
Fully
awakened. Not
fully awakened.
Awakened, but fully awakened.
Fully.
Okay. The only thing I can say is that I met many different masters. But one of the things that was striking to me is that they had attained obviously something, which for me, awakening is about de-grasping.
Awakening is not suddenly about becoming like a Christmas tree. That's not my idea of awakening. My idea of awakening is of less and less grasping. So I have been with great master with this field of non-grasping, I would say. You were with them, and actually even your own grasping would disappear because there is this field. But for my example, my teacher, Master Kuzan, was reputed to have had 3 awakenings. You would think, well, 1 would be enough. But no, he had 2. But the fact that he had 3 awakenings did not mean that he'd stopped practicing. Mm-hmm. And the thing he said to me, 6 months before he died, we were walking together. And he was a bit weak, and we sat on a trunk, and he said, you know, you never know how you're going to be when you die. Even I don't know how I'm going to be when I die. So we have to practice. So we are ready. Any moment it happens. And we'll be the most stable and open we can be. And this is what he did. Till the last day of his life, he sat in meditation. So that's what I wanted to say about that one.
I'll come back to that once we get on to the next, onto the 4 truths, because that will deal exactly with that point.
Okay, and I think we have to stop and have lunch.
And an announcement.
אין לנו פעמונאי או פעמונאית לחלק השני של היום. תמשיכי. אז בבקשה, אחרי ארוחת צהריים, לצלצל בעוז, בכל החדרים, גם של הגברים, כדי שכולם יגיעו. יודעים את הבלדינג, אני רוצה. תודה.
So now we continue back to the meditation awareness, back to the silence, and back to, again, to notice, back to the